just commissioning a report and saying, look, we need to run this place more as a kind of holding camp now for what's going to happen to people. There's a small number of people who eventually will face some sort of trial. And there's a majority of people in here who really, you know, are not going to stay here and they're going to be released.
Well, now, for really now, we're going to have to leave it there, Andy, I'm sorry to say. I think this is an ongoing story. I mean, I know it's an ongoing story and something we need to keep paying attention to. And I want to let the KBOO audience know that they can go and find out more about Guantanamo Always by looking at your writings. And they can go to www.andyworthington.co.uk. And it links to many, many other things. But the information available just instantly on there is really excellent, and I continue to turn to you as a source of information about Guantanamo. So thank you so much for joining us here today and for the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Linda, for the latest installment. And, you know, let's hope we get to talk again. But more importantly, let's hope that, you know, we see some action from President Obama in closing the place down.
Yes, and with the right disbursement of the prisoners there, with one that cares for justice.
Exactly.
Well, thank you again, and I'm going to tell the KBOO audience coming up next is Emily Young. She interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? And I'll leave you going out with music by Dave Rovix. It's While We Torture Our Prisoners.
After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners.
Tune into the KBOO Yiddish Hour on Sunday, March 29th, as we look at the concepts of eco-kashrut, a growing movement to reinterpret Jewish dietary laws. Eco-kashrut expands on traditional kosher practice by incorporating the ethics of sustainable growing systems, humane animal production, and fair treatment for farm workers. We'll be talking to some of the movement's primary shapers, as well as a couple of Portland's own Jewish organic farmers. So save the date, Sunday, March 29th at 10 a.m., right here on KBOO, and tell your friends.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
It's 9:30. You're listening to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland 90.7. Still to come at 10, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Greg Palace talks about the anniversary of the Valdez spill and the economic meltdown. Also a short interview with Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. At 11 on Stage and Studio, Demay Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Up next, host Emily Young interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, a critique of politicians, the media, and the food industry.
Yeah. Hello, welcome everybody. Good morning, and if all the buttons are working, Joel Berg has joined us today. Joel, are you there?
I am indeed, and I'm thrilled to be following that uplifting gospel music instead of that torture song.
That was Ry Cooter, and it was about having to bring a woman home as pay, but I thought the very thing that makes you rich makes me poor. Hi, Joel. I'm Emily Young, and I want to tell folks about your book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? And I have to tell you first that the cover is what sold me on this book because it's an old diner sign, which I just love, and I feel like asking for two sides.
Well, there you have it. And I'm so glad the publisher worked with me to do that because most books on hunger have sort of a maudlin picture of a starving child on the cover. And most books on hunger are fairly maudlin, honestly. Mine has a little humor in it. Someone praised my good-natured snarkiness. So I think the cover reflects the tone of the book, that it's obviously about an issue that's deadly serious, but we can show a little of the ridiculous irony of having hunger in a society with so much wealth and so much agricultural plenty.
Right. And of course, you've done a lot of background work, very heavily researched, and yet isn't heavy, which I thank you for that. I want to dive right in to let you know that I myself am ramen rich and probably root canal poor. And in Oregon, as you state in your book, that our food insecurity rates are higher than our poverty rates. And food insecurity, which I'm feeling, as you say, food insecure enough to eat a horse, is the new phrase for hunger. Is that right?
That's correct. In the Clinton administration, we helped develop a methodology that described the broader notion of food insecurity, that for most people in America who didn't have enough food, it wasn't quite as bad as Darfur or North Korea because we still have a federal nutrition safety net. People weren't starving in the streets. They were more likely to be choosing between food and rent, choosing between food and medicine. But then we said that a subset of that characterization, the most severe form of food insecurity should be described as hunger. People actually skipping meals, having pangs of lack of food, and the Bush administration actually stopped using the term hunger entirely, instead using the term very low food security, which does sort of have an Orwellian twist to it. I think if we have newspaper headlines all the time, and I collect newspaper references and pop culture references to hunger, if we can say if you've gone an hour without your Snickers bar, you're hungry, if Venus and Serena Williams or Tiger Woods are hungry for a win, if an executive's hungry for their next promotion, I think we can certainly say that people who lack enough food are hungry.
Now let's tell folks why you know so much about this and who you are exactly. Joel Berg worked under Dan Glickman in the USDA under Bill Clinton. Is that correct?
That's correct. Dan Glickman was the Secretary of Agriculture, my immediate boss, and I was a political appointee in the Clinton administration, and I did spend all 8 years of the Clinton administration at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Right, and you are now currently the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger.
I am indeed. We are an umbrella group for the more than 1,200 soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City, and they serve a startling 1.3 million low-income New Yorkers.
And also, the book that you've written is actually a treatise that you are planning to take. It came out before you knew the outcome of the election, but you plan on taking it to the President of the United States and offering it to him as a guideline to how to cure hunger in America. You believe that it's possible. How quick is it possible if we follow your guidelines?
Well, President Obama has actually called for ending child hunger in America by 2015 as a down payment on ending all hunger in America. So I believe that is actually a very realistic goal. And I must say, my book is extraordinarily critical of the American political establishment for not more thoroughly addressing this issue in the last few decades. I point out that when government did address this issue in the 1960s and 1970s by creating the safety net programs that we have today, although in tattered form, that we had dramatic progress in reducing hunger. So the single most important takeaway point from my book for folks is that it's not a hopeless situation, that we don't have just an automatically fixed level of hunger. It's not set by nature like the size of the Cascade Mountains. I always try to get local references. Hunger goes up or down based on human actions and particularly governmental actions. And now that we have a president who's pledged to end child hunger and he's really put his money where his mouth is, serious money in the stimulus package with great support from people like Senator Wyden, serious money in his budget, we have a real hope for the first time in a very long time that we can finally end hunger in America.
Some of the facts in your books, up until, of course, Chapter 12, when you start outlining the cure, were things that shocked and surprised me. I didn't realize that many states require fingerprints from food stamp recipients and the amount of trouble that people have to go to. And, of course, now it's called SNAP. That is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That people are actually having to give fingerprints in lieu of what's gone on with the bailouts and just money given away willy-nilly to corporations and CEOs. And again, you address this in your book pretty specifically, giving actual numbers and names of what is expected of corporate welfare and as opposed to people on assistance programs. When did the fingerprinting come into play and go on a little bit more about that?
You know, fingerprinting came into play in the late 1990s in a handful of states. Now it's only exists in four states. My supposedly liberal, but not really liberal, home state of New York, California, Arizona, and Texas. And you do mention my comparisons to corporate welfare. You know, I wrote the book about a year and a half ago, and my opening line for my chapter on inequality of wealth was, the last time we had this much inequality of wealth was 1929, and we know what happened after that. And I don't think I was particularly prescient. I think the people who cared to look understood that if you had this much inequality of wealth, the society could not last and could not prosper. And I contrast in mind-numbing detail, but fun mind-numbing detail, you know, the ease with which corporations get their welfare with the difficulty with which a poor working family gets food stamps. Finger imaging does not prevent fraud. The four states with finger imaging or fingerprinting, it's sort of an electronic way of fingerprinting, actually have higher rates of error in the food stamps program than the 46 states that don't. Oregon doesn't have more fraud in the food stamps program because it doesn't treat poor people automatically like criminals. The reasons we have fingerprinting in New York is politics, that our elected officials get to stand up saying, we're tough on poor people, we're tough on fraud, even though it does nothing except waste taxpayer money. And the other thing is the companies that control the technology and get money from these contracts lobby heavily against eliminating. So it's a ridiculous system. But we have a long history in America, as I point out in my book, of blaming the victim. Other countries early in their histories developed social welfare systems. We developed debtor's prison. So if you're poor, you go to prison. You know, the funny thing is, when I wrote my book, I thought I was going to be really out there on corporate welfare. Now it's sort of old hat. I'm pretty moderate.
You really are. You kind of pulled your punches, in retrospect.
I thought it was tough a year and a half ago, and people say this is radical. I called for corporate executives paying their fair share of taxes, and maybe instead of having seven vacation homes, have five vacation homes and pay their workers enough to feed their families with the money saved. Now there's a conservative Republican senator from Iowa saying AIG executives should commit hari-kari. I'm pretty moderate. I just say they should pay their fair share of taxes and pay their workers enough so they don't starve. That's moderate.
It is so gross, and even you mentioned Goldman Sachs as an example, and then having them be part of the bailout is glaring in the fact that they had record profits in 06.
I do find it ironic that everyone seems to be up in arms. Oh, my God, government money is going to failing corporations that we're supporting. You know, like the scene from Casablanca when they find the gambling here. I'm shocked. There's been corporate welfare in America for decades and decades and decades. That money's come out of programs that could have been helping low-income working families, poor families, and families struggling to stay in the middle class, could have helped them with food, could have helped them with affordable housing. And frankly, now that the elites of society and some of the mainstream media elites have their own stock portfolios in trouble, now they're shocked. Now they're outraged. I agree people should be outraged that AIG is still giving bonuses, but this is not a new thing. As I point out in the book, Goldman Sachs, one of the wealthiest corporations on the planet, in 2006, the average employee got $600,000 bonuses, and they were getting tens of millions of dollars from city, state, and federal government to build a sparkling new headquarters just a few blocks from their own headquarters, which was just a few decades old. You know, the Colosseums lasted a few thousand years in Rome. I can't imagine a corporate headquarters couldn't last, you know, more than 40 years without our tax dollars paying for a new one.
Right. And I want to remind people who've just joined us, we're speaking with Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? This outlines the problem and problems with just the misspending and the wrong allotment of our funds going to corporations, and how the hungry have been undercut in this country. And now people just have a hard time believing that there's any hungry people in America, and that if they're hungry, they're probably hungry due to mental health reasons, or maybe they're lazy, or they're drug addicted, but that's really not the case, is it? Most hungry people are working families, people who are working often more than two jobs, three jobs, and trying to live on $28.30 of food. You, along with our governor and quite a few other people, took the challenge in April of 2007 to eat as if you were on food stamps. How did that go for you?
It was tough. I must say, you know, for all the bad news in Oregon about hunger, the only good news is, while elected officials in other parts of the country sort of blame the messenger, and when USDA put out figures about how hunger was increasing in their state, they just denied it. In Oregon, your leaders actually started doing something about it. I think it's incredibly wonderful that your governor, the highest-ranking elected official arguably in the state, decided to live for a week the way the least powerful do on the food stamps program. And I must say, I'm not just sucking up because I'm coming to Portland tonight for a reading at Powell's, but, you know, Senator Wyden's been really great on this. So living on the food stamps diet for $28.30 for a week was tough. My partner cooked everything from scratch and shopped for me because I was out ranting about hunger and doing my other stuff. And even then, it was extraordinarily difficult. I barely survived. I couldn't afford a single organic product. I couldn't afford a single beverage. So I could get a mealy 30-cent apple from a store across the street. I live down the street in Brooklyn, New York, from an amazing farmer's market, and I could not afford a single product there, could not afford even a 50-cent apple. I had a Jewish mother who I was supposed to spend Mother's Day with. We always went out to Chinese food, not to be stereotypical, but we did. I explained to her dozens of times before this date that I couldn't go out to a restaurant with her because you can't use food stamps at a restaurant, and by the way, I couldn't afford it anyway if I could. And she said, yes, I fully understand. And then she offered me food 17 times that day. Yes, I counted 17 times. So yeah, there are psychological impacts about not having enough food. There are physiological impacts about not having enough food. But this week also reminded me just how central food is to our daily sort of family and human existence. We socialize around food. I couldn't go out to, you know, to eat with colleagues. I couldn't go out to eat, with friends. So it was really challenging. One other point I'd make is, you know how the Hollywood stars who need free things the least get it the most? They go to these big awards ceremonies and they get swag bags full of stuff. Well, white-collar workers such as myself get free food all the time. It really struck me during this week. I go to a breakfast meeting with food. I go to a lunch meeting with food. I go to a reception honoring some hunger group, mine or some others, and the shrimp cocktail are flowing almost as freely as the regular cocktails. And so the people who need free food least in society get it all throughout their lives. The people who need it the most have to get fingerprinted to apply for food stamps.
At the time you wrote this book, Joel Berg, the hunger problem has increased dramatically. What do you think's happened since a year ago when you finished this book?
Well, as I wrote the book, I said things had gone from bad to worse. We were just starting an economic downturn, and food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens were simply running out of food to meet the growing demand. Now, my partner cringes when I use this phrase because it's horrible English, but I'll use it anyway. Things have gone from worse to worser. If hunger was a river overflowing its banks in past years, now it's just a tidal wave. In New York City, there was a 28% increase in people using food pantries and soup kitchens over the last year, and even worse than that, or worser than that, if I may, two-thirds of the pantries and kitchens in New York City ran out of food. So another key point of my book is that, please, the public should not be conned into believing that charities are solving this problem. They are not. They are barely scratching the surface. Trying to end hunger, which impacts now 36.2 million Americans with just canned food drives, is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. Thank goodness there are some really progressive food banks around the country. And again, I'm not just sucking up because I'm in Oregon, but the Oregon Food Bank is one of the most progressive food banks in the country. They had the guts to come out for a minimum wage increase. They do a lot of things to support community food security. They understand it's not just about continuing to give out the same old charity food. But even with their amazing efforts, without government taking the lead, they're never going to be able to end the problem.
You say it's essential for government to take the lead.
Absolutely. People say to me, Joel, why are you so pro-government? Why don't you have community solve the problem? And I remind people that in democracy, government should be the embodiment of community. I have a chart in my book where I point out that if we entirely double the charitable food distribution system in America, which now spends about $2 billion a year on food, we barely dent the hunger problem. But if we increase the federal nutrition assistance safety net by only 41%, and that safety net's about $65 billion a year now, we can entirely end hunger in America. So I'll leave it up to your listeners. Would you rather just dent the problem by feeling good about another canned food drive, or do you really want to end the problem? And I've also calculated that we could end the problem for $24 billion a year, but it costs our economy to have hunger $90 billion a year because hungry children learn less well, hungry workers work less productively, hungry people cost our society far more in healthcare. So if someone came to you and said, a handy person, and said, there's a leak in your roof, and it costs you $90 a year in extra spending on utilities for heat and cooling, and we could fix it for $24, wouldn't you do it? Well, that's the situation we face in hunger. Of course we should fix the problem for $24 billion if it costs us $90 billion.
Again, tonight, Joel Berg, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? He's going to be at Powell City of Books at 7:30 p.m. He's going to talk about his book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, on Seven Stories Press. Joel, you mention Oregon a lot as a standout. We do have our, I don't think it's mentioned in the book, but we do have now the ability to use the SNAP cards, the supplemental cards, the food stamp cards, I guess we'll call the Oregon Trail cards, at farmers markets.
Yes.
Is this something that's taking off around the nation?
It is. You know, over the last few decades, food stamps moved away from being a paper coupon to being a card similar to an ATM card or a credit card. It was a very positive advance. Advocates like myself loved it because it reduced stigma. Even conservatives loved it because it did reduce fraud. The only problem with it was that at farmers markets around the country, it dramatically reduced the use of food stamps benefits. Because to use these cards, you needed both electricity and a phone connection. So places like Oregon have been in the lead in this. We've been making a lot of progress in New York City on this. We helped farmers get handheld wireless devices that can accept these benefits. And I must say, even some people who think of themselves as liberals and nutritionists say, oh, low-income people are just too ignorant and uneducated to know that they need fresh produce. That's poppycock. I can say poppycock on the radio, I think.
In New York City, so far.
Yeah, right, until the FCC bans that.
Right.
Well, I know the word poppy is dangerous. Anyway, in New York City, the number of the food stamps redemptions at farmers markets have increased threefold in the first few years that these markets have accepted these benefits. So I know that low-income people, like everyone else, desperately wants the freshest produce, the best food for their families. And when they have the economic capacity and the physical ability to get this food, they will definitely get it and serve it to their families.
Right now, a lot of poor people can't get to the farmers markets, can't get the fresh produce because it's not in their neighborhood. The lack of supermarkets, you say, makes a concrete difference. Areas without a full range of markets are obesogenic.
Yeah, I love that word.
Obesity producing. So that's one of the far right's of big arguments against hunger in America, that we're an obese society. What about that, Joel?
I have a whole chapter in my book called Is America Fat or Is It Hungry? And I basically document in very clear detail, but fun detail again, that hunger and obesity are actually flip sides of the same malnutrition coin. That when you are poor and can't afford the most nutritious food that's the least fattening food, you have to buy the least nutritious food that's the cheapest that fills your belly. Not only that, low-income people, again, are less likely to have food stores in their neighborhood that have fresh produce. Even in the Pacific Northwest that produces such great produce, it's in a ridiculous irony that many low-income neighborhoods, and not just in cities and rural areas, don't have this stuff, even if they grow it nearby. And lastly, low-income people are less likely to have a public park nearby that's safe to exercise in. They're less likely to have a gym nearby or afford a gym membership. So being poor definitely adds to the obesity rate. And I challenge not only the conservatives who deny the problem, but also sort of some of my friends who are foodies, who sort of focus only on the availability of pristine greens in sort of yuppie boutique, you know, programs or their nice, you know, farmers market in the yuppie neighborhood. I say we've got to be concerned about small farmers. We've got to be concerned about organic food, but we've got to make it more economically affordable, and we've got to make it available not just in the yuppie neighborhoods, but in every neighborhood of America.
Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. Your book is fascinating. There's so much I wish we could go into, but half an hour just isn't enough time. One of the chapters, Chapter 7, Dickens Revisited, Life in the New Gilded Age, where it starts out with a quote from Michael Bloomberg, New York City mayor: some things people can afford, some things people can't. And also former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney: if there wasn't enough reasons to dislike the man, here we are. Sometimes you get frustrated when I hear politicians say there are two Americas. I don't believe there are two Americas. There's a model of thought among Democrats that the amount of money, the amount of wealth in a nation is a fixed amount, and that if Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are making a lot of money, that just means somebody else is not able to make as much. That happens to be entirely false. Is that entirely false, Joel?
No, it is not. And it's fairly easy for Mitt Romney to say, as a millionaire, there are definitely two Americas.
Millionaire, you mean 350 millionaire? He had $350 million.
Yeah, that's nothing. Last year, there were so many billionaires in America that merely having $1 billion wasn't enough to get you on the Forbes 400 list. And I don't begrudge billionaires their money, but I point out in the book this sort of myth we've developed that they earned it all on their own is preposterous. They are supported by government roads they ship their goods over. Internet billionaires are sometimes the most anti-government folks around. And while Al Gore didn't personally invent the internet, people tend to forget the internet was invented by government. Even, you know, educated workforces like a Microsoft workforce, many of the folks there went to public schools, public universities. Facilities are protected by government firefighters and government police officers. This myth in America that anyone is entirely self-made is really preposterous. And the good news is, even people like Warren Buffett say that's preposterous. He points out he went to a public university. He points out his personal success owes a lot to society. So I don't begrudge billionaires their billions. I just wish they were once again paying even close to their fair share of taxes. This claim that Obama's budget proposals are making us a socialist nation is just laughable. His budget proposals, his taxation proposals, would merely move tax levels for the ultra-rich to lower levels than they were in the Reagan era. We're not redistributing the wealth. We're just marginally reclaiming some of the wealth we've already given away to the richest in our society. And I think that just makes sense. I'm actually a committed capitalist. You know, my grandparents came here and built a better life for themselves and their grandchildren for hard work. But that's not how people are getting ahead today. It's basically based on who they know, and it's crony capitalism that's replaced opportunity capitalism. So I believe in opportunity capitalism with a safety net for those who can't make it, and that's what we need to do in America. And if we do that, we can end hunger.
You outline the specifics of this in the final chapters of your book. Again, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, and you will be speaking tonight at Powell's on Burnside at 7:30. I also have some numbers I'd like to give folks out that they're experiencing hunger right now. And there are some phone numbers. This is the Oregon State Information Hotline number. It's 1-800-723-7233. 3638. And if you're in the Portland area, that's 503-988-5888. If you go online, you can go to OregonHelps.org. That's one word, OregonHelps.org. We have an organization in town, Food Not Bombs. And if you go to the Portland India Media website, they will give you the where they're going to be serving in town. Lots of emergency hunger relief organizations here in town. We have also the Oregon State University Extension Family and Community. That's www.extension.oregonstate.edu. And I don't expect everybody to write all these things down. I'm going to have all these things up at the front desk for those people who want to call our front desk who don't have access to computers. I found that if you write in SNAP, that will take you someplace. Oregon SafeNet is another place. And in Salem, the number for information there for the Salem-Keizer School Kaiser School District is 503-399-3151. And the difference between, we don't have time to get into it, but Joel, you'll be in town tonight again at Powell's. That's Powell's City Books on Burnside at 7:30. The book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? And it's out by, Seven Stories Press. And you thank them and your mother, Belle, and your father, Bernard, who gave your mind a hunger for learning. And Joel, we look forward to seeing you tonight in Portland, and thanks for writing the book.
Okay, thank you so much for your time and your interest in this issue.
And we're going to continue on. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party features DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation/KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.